Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Every year, one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services, so your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. It's like your own personal post office. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code program.
Really, 007.
Okay, welcome to the Really 007 podcast for our third look into the James Bond songbook. You can find us and listen in on iTunes and Spotify. And we're on social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So tonight, I'm joined by our regular contributors, Rob Park and Chris Goldie, although I don't think Rob's been on for quite some time, so it's good to have you back, gents.
Yeah, I'm stoked to be here, man. Stoked.
Good stuff. But the first time you guys have been on talking about the James Bond songbook, so I'm really interested in what you've got to say about all these songs we're going to discuss tonight. But we've also got a very special guest, Mr. Steve Clamp, who I believe is a newsreader, reporter, producer, presenter extraordinaire for ITV. So welcome, Steve, to the podcast.
It is great to be here and really nice to be asked to join you guys. I've loved hearing your podcast recently, so thank you.
Yeah. I love that people, you know, like genuine people like Steve, like hear it and go like, yeah, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah. It's been of minimal use to lots of people over lockdown, I think. Background noise. But no, good to have you on, and it's all about a relaxed atmosphere, sharing silly opinions and some serious opinions though, particularly when we talk about the current state of the franchise. We get a bit more serious, don't we, opposed to discussing J.W. Pepper or things like that. So, lots of fun to be had. Anyway, without further ado, nice to meet you, Steve. So just a little bit of background on yourself. What do you do for a living, and how did you get into James Bond?
Okay, so living first, yeah, viewers of the telly would say I was a TV presenter, but as you sort of alluded to on my intro, there's a lot more to it than that. You're a journalist and producer and writing and stuff. And I work for ITV News, mostly for their programme Central News, which is in the Midlands. So hi to all those viewers. And I also do little bits and pieces from other shows as well. We've recently been doing a show series called All Around Britain, which has been on ITV on the network, and I did some stuff for that. And over the years, yeah, I've popped up on a few other things. I was on the BBC for a few years and Sky for a few years. And I'm kind of one of those people that you probably look at in the street and think, I'm sure I know him from somewhere. And then you realise that it's not actually the uncle you thought I was. But yeah, and I love my role. But as for James Bond, well, I mean, like a lot of us, in fact, you know, I think I could big ITV up here, because I think ITV played a big part in our association with Bond.
Absolutely.
As kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of us will remember a time where you couldn't easily get a VHS or a DVD of all the films. And there was always, you could rely on ITV on a bank holiday to put on a Bond film. And you know, kept the franchise in the forefront of everyone's imagination. That's certainly where I first saw the Bond films, would have been on ITV as a kid. And I tell you a little funny thing is that you'll obviously remember Never Say Never Again coming out. That was obviously a new film in 83. I don't know when it came on TV, but it would have been probably mid to late 80s, along with the equivalent Roger Moore or Octopussy. And I that in my mind made me think they were both James Bond at the same time. I thought Connery and Roger Moore just were both Bond actors at the same time. Obviously, they were for one film, but I mean, I thought all that it just carried on, the two of them. And it was, I was much older when I found out that wasn't the case. Like, I was probably 40. No, maybe I was younger than that, but yeah, it took a while. And, but I do remember as a kid, and this probably sounds like sacrilege, but as a kid, I remember if it came on a Bond film, I'd start watching it. If it had Connery in it, I'd be like, oh, it's one of the boring ones. And if it was Roger Moore, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm staying for this. I've changed a little bit. I still love Roger Moore.
That was great.
But I also like Connery now. And that's it. I've had a few little minor associations. I was dating a girl in the 90s whose family worked in films, and they did a lot on GoldenEye. And they got me a cast and crew film jacket because they knew I was obviously hyper big about Bond. And if she went and did her work experience on GoldenEye. I mean, how nuts is that? Yeah. And some of the scene where the train crashes into the tank, the obviously it's a model with Derek Meddings was doing all that. The trees along the side, the little model trees, she planted some of those trees, a work experience. I mean, that's nuts, right?
That's incredible.
So, I mean, the relationship didn't last forever, but I've still got the Bond jacket. I've still got the cast and crew jacket. And that was amazing. And I used to wear that around college. And funny enough, at the same time, I just actually got my first TV presenter gig on a kids' TV show. So I was still at college and I was on telly. And I had like this film crew jacket. Can you imagine how I'd gone from being a complete geek in everyone's eyes to being so cool just for a few months? It was a great time to be alive.
Honestly, I'd have been like, if we were on campus, I'd have been like, I need to find that guy. I need to be friends with that guy. Immediately.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Buy me a pie.
Buy me a pie. Yeah.
Also, as a family, we never went to the cinema much, but I certainly, the first film I vividly remember seeing at the cinema. There were others before, but vividly was License to Kill. I was 13. I don't think I can get arrested for it now.
License to Kill at the cinema?
Blame my mum. You know, she took me underage to see License to Kill. And I remember we walked past the huge queues that were there for Batman. And we went in and there was like four of us in the cinema watching License to Kill. But we pretty much had it to ourselves. But I think I had actually probably seen A View to a Kill in the Living Daylights. But I was just too young to clearly remember. I remember having posters that my mum had got us of A View to a Kill on the walls. So I can only assume you went to see the film. But I don't vividly remember.
Do you have the ones from Smith's Crisps?
Yes, yes.
James had those, yeah.
I was jealous because my brother had the one with Roger Moore on the Eiffel Tower, like holding the gun and looking really cool. And I had the one with the helicopter, and it was an action shot. But after a while, I was like, well, that could be any helicopter. I want Bond, you know. So I was always a little bit jealous of that. But those were the posters we had.
Steve, can I ask? Like, I've never spoken to anyone who saw License to Kill in the cinema, I don't think.
So because you don't know anyone old enough, that's what you're saying.
No, as in, like, because we always talk about...
Apart from Anthony Stark, who saw it, who's in it. Yeah, you're right.
That's true. But, like, because Chris, you saw Living Daylights in the cinema, didn't you?
I did, that was the first one I saw, yeah.
Yeah, but, like... with that, like, Bond having gone harder for License to Kill, at 13, how did it leave you when you were in the cinema watching?
Yeah.
Do you know what? I didn't... I was quite a sensitive kid, and yet I didn't get overly shocked by any of it. I just was in the moment. For 2 hours, I was utterly thrilled. And I remember being at school the next day and just... And none of my friends had been to see it. I think they were probably, you know, thinking, oh, I can't believe he's been to see a 15, you know. I just was blown away. And I just wish more people had been. And I think, you know, License to Kill's like... it's an honour, Her Majesty's Secret Service. In time, more and more people would come round. And I think, actually, if you listen to podcasts with fans, most fans in Europe are on board with this now. And it's America's always a bit behind. And I think they'll get there in the end.
We're flying the flag for License to Kill. We make no bones about that.
Oh, yeah.
Say, it's like, our favourite, basically.
By my desk right now.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, exactly. That is beautiful.
Rob's study is adorned with Dalton images, I think.
It is. Ray Dalton.
I must just briefly, because I should have mentioned this before, with the GoldenEye thing, with the family working on it, I did go to the cast and crew premiere as well in Leicester Square of GoldenEye. So, yeah. So, there you go. That's
really...
That's I've got no more stories. That's as cool as I got. I peaked in 1995, and it's been a gradual slope downhill since
then.
So
did the franchise. No. 89. Yeah. Oh, dear me. It's just a joy just to speak to people who have loved it for that long. And I guess, like you say, ITV, growing up, you knew the best ones by the ones you had on video. Like, I think Moonraker we hadn't recorded on video for some years, so we weren't really aware of that one. And License to Kill, because it was 15, I don't think we had it on proper video. We couldn't see it at the cinema. Like Batman, I mean, two about the best films ever made, never mind in the same week. Both 15s underrated. But yeah, when we recorded it and it was finally on ITV, I mean, it's just, that's one of our favourites, as we unashamedly say, but some of the others we'll talk about. So in terms of your favourites, Bond, you've said obviously Roger Moore. There are some other characters as well, and Connery you've mentioned, but Dalton's the other one, and then Brosnan, I suppose. But
yeah, I mean,
even Lazenby. Yeah.
There's no question for me that my favourite Bond, and I've said this, I had a slight waver on this once, but I think that the best James Bond is Timothy Dalton. I just think he brought so much to the role. And this sounds a bit of, my wife would call me a dishcloth for this, but I get a bit emotional when I think that Dalton didn't do another film, because I feel we all lost out. I think everybody lost out on...
Oh my God.
Two films.
Become best friends, Steve.
yeah.
Oh my word.
I mean, I'll go as far as say I don't believe that if they'd had Dalton in a Bond film, they could have made a bad Bond film, because I don't think he would have let it happen. Mm. And plus, his performance would obviously... I'm not saying he would have always made the greatest Bond film. You can't do everything. But I don't believe with him in it, a bad Bond film would have been made. And you know what? I'd have been quite happy for John Glenn to do another, because I think... There was a bit of friction, I understand, between him and Dalton on License to Kill. But hey, look at the film they came out with. And I think, you know, they probably brought out the best in each other, even if it did mean a few arguments, you know. It was great. John Glenn's a solid director. He might not be the most artistic or whatever, but he's a solid director. And when you've got someone like Timothy Dalton there who's passionate about getting the character right and the scenes right, I just think you've got absolute winning formula. And it does make me a bit emotional that he didn't do more, because I just think it's a huge loss for all of us. But yeah, I understand why it didn't happen. And that's the way the cookie crumbles. And to be fair to Pierce, I actually thought he was outstanding in Goldeneye. And I thought it was one of those films that there's certain Bond films that have been important that it kept going. I think, you know, Goldfinger was a definitive Bond film. You know, it's not actually my favourite Connery film, but I think from a point of view of it making Bond big and then bringing that whole kind of superhero kind of spy thriller with all the gadgets and everything. You've got Goldfinger. I think The Spy Who Loved Me was a similar thing. It kind of just, bang, here's a great, great action film, just when the series was flagging a bit. And I think Goldeneye probably did similar. And if it hadn't been that Goldeneye was so good and Pierce was so good in it, the series could well have died at that film, you know, because it was in a difficult place. So, you know, fair credit to Pierce, but I do love Timothy Dalton. We ought to have a moment to pause there.
Well,
reflection.
No.
A moment of silence.
So much to take in, Steve. It is an emotional business. Yeah. Particularly with Dalton in the role, my word.
Oh, yeah.
Got quite emotional License to Kill, didn't it? But...
And do you know what? I will shut up about Dalton, I promise. But sometimes when I'm watching some of the other films, I imagine what Dalton would have been like. Little scenes. I'm like, what look would he have given now? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
The look he gives when he was married once. I mean, that's...
Oh,
just...
no, don't. Yeah. Don't.
Yeah.
Just acting, isn't it?
I know it's been said on the podcast before, but for Steve's benefit, can I... When I got married in 2013, my brother and I were in protracted negotiations with... What district was this? I don't know. But the Merseyside Health and Safety, about whether we could do the entrance to my wedding as James and Felix parachute in grey suits with tails. And we were given the no, we can't do it, but we were going to do it.
Yeah. Would you have had to catch a drug baron before you did the jump?
Yeah, somewhere off Birkenhead we were going to catch...
Going fishing!
Yeah. I mean, But that would have been amazing. That's the level of influence that those films had on us. I mean, I totally agree. I find it so hard to accept almost that Dalton only had two cracks at James Bond when he was that good in both incarnations, both iterations, sorry. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything you've said. Honestly, I feel fulfilled as a man hearing what you just said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Steve, that Dalton and, you know, License to Kill, they're getting a lot more appreciation now from Britain and Europe. And I think somebody once said recently that the current Bond is usually compared, if they're quite popular at the time, and it's always like, oh, he's going back to Connery and he's the best after Connery. And then, you know, Brosnan was extremely popular at the time. But then when Craig came along, people was almost, not laughing at him, but GoldenEye was good, yeah, but, you know, the rest of it was pretty silly. And they grouped them all in with Die of the Day.
Hmm.
And I think the same happened with Dalton when Brosnan came along, because he was so good and it had been so long, he got forgotten a bit. But now Daniel Craig's doing the, in inverted commas, grittier Bonds. Dalton's been more, I don't know, getting a bit more good reputation among the Bond fans. So I'm hoping the same will happen for Pierce, because I think his popularity is unquestionable at the time he was Bond. It's just a bit trendy perhaps now to sort of have a little Pierce bashing, particularly on Twitter. But,
yeah, and I feel for Pierce a bit, because I think in GoldenEye he showed how brilliant he could be. And I think in Tomorrow Never Dies he was pretty good, but he just didn't have the scripts or the great films. I mean, obviously, Die Another Day is just woeful. But even The World Is Not Enough for me. And actually, funnily enough, you know, I know some people actually quite like it, but for me, it feels a bit tortuous. And the whole Denise Richards thing, you just feel like, what were they doing? No disrespect to her, but she was just massively miscast in that role. And I don't know. It just didn't fit right with me with Pierce. But GoldenEye, he's absolutely great because he's in a great film. And I think if he's one of those actors that if you give him a good script and a good film, he'll be good. But he isn't one of those actors perhaps who can salvage a terrible film, whereas some others can do quite a bit of work there. Nobody could have salvaged Die Another Day. I mean, if you put Timothy Dalton in Die Another Day, he would still be awful.
But I would love to have seen him try.
We've got some good Twine defenders, but we wouldn't have any major Dad defenders, I wouldn't have said. But, some of it.
Hate The World Is Enough. And when I walked out the cinema having seen it, you know, I thought it was great. But it just in time, I've lost a bit of love for it.
Oh, heck.
Die Another Day was the first film I did a bit of film reviewing for the BBC some years ago. And it was the first film I went as a critic to go and review was Die Another Day. And actually, I found my review. I don't know where it is now. I found it a couple of years ago when I was moving house. And I was certainly gentle with my criticism compared to how I knew I actually felt. I think I was worried that because it was my first gig, I'd gone in overly critical, you know, and I hadn't just watched it properly. You know what I mean? I was just, because I thought it can't be as bad as I just thought it was. And then later, when I saw it again, I realised, no, actually, it was, in fact, it was worse.
You're watching it as a Bond fan as well, aren't you? So the expectation levels are so cranked up.
You want to like it. You really want to love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's so much.
Did you want to like Spectre of?
Oh, yeah. I remember. No, seriously. I remember watching the first sort of 40 minutes and thinking, this isn't bad. This is okay. And then we...
Yeah. I completely agree. Completely agree. And actually, when I walked out of Spectre at the cinema... I didn't load it as much as it should have been. I kind of just went with it because my expectations weren't high, put it that way. And I thought, oh, it actually wasn't bad. There's some great visuals in it and some wonderful set pieces. And I've got admiration for how they do some of those things. I think, wow, you know, that is some work. But then you really start to think, but this is just ridiculous. And to make it effectively the completion of a trilogy, which whether you're big fans of those first two, or not, they set up a really intriguing, really scary, underworld criminal organisation. And then the way it was all just kind of revealed was just pathetic.
Yeah, that's the... It was so disappointing that the reveal that Mr. White's role was... Well, it was nothing, really. I mean...
Yeah. Exactly. This incredible organisation that for two films, MI6 had no idea who any of them were. And then Bond finds it all out when they have a little meeting and just announce everything they're doing around a table.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost, it could be Austin Powers would have done that, you know, and it's
Purvis and Wade. So sorry.
It reduces the impact of the others, doesn't it?
Cause yeah.
For have to have Silver involved with the whole thing is nothing. You know, he was never about Quantum or Spectre or anything. So spoils that, and as if Casino Royale and all, whatever you think about it, that whole storyline gearing up to some clues which are pointed out with sort of photos in a glass booth at the end, exactly like Mission Impossible.
Photocopies of photos.
Photocopy, yeah.
Gosh. Don't you think the problem with that is that you've really got to have confidence that what you're going to pull off will not only tie everything together, but will make sense through all the other films. And clearly that wasn't. So what you're doing is that because they absolutely failed at that, you start to drag down these individual films because now you can't really separate it from, oh, this was all his plan and that kind of, it's just ridiculous. It's such a shame. This is why I do think we need to have just standalone adventures because, you know, the quality of films has been, there, you know, ups and downs and, you know, and there's always something to enjoy. But yeah, I think definitely no more of that nonsense, please.
I think the only way it can work if you're going to do a trilogy of films is that you have the story to start with, a complete story arc. You're not just like, well, we'll make that bit up and make it work when we get there, because that's when you end up with a mess like this. You know, if you take, I'm not a fan of Lord of the Rings, but I know lots of people are, and that's obviously started from a point of having a beginning, middle, and end because it was written already, and then it works. It works as a trilogy, and George Lucas's original Star Wars films work pretty much as a trilogy because he knew where he needed to go, but certainly with the first Star Wars, it works as a standalone film as well. But with this, it just feels like they were making up as they went along. They had great ideas, but then they didn't know where to go with them each time. And they would, But listen, we're not here to talk about Spectre. Well, don't do this to me. It's
late. It would be an episode if it wasn't tangent.
Exactly.
The tangents are fine.
But it's so great when you get to speak to another passionate Bond fan and your conversation just blossoms from there. I wanted to ask Steve, you know, you mentioned that you weren't didn't have high expectations for Spectre. What about No Time to Die?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, my expectations are pretty low. But there's a thing with the Daniel Craig Bond films, and I don't want to get at them because I think in some respects, I mean, Casino Royale, I think as a film, forget Bond as a film, I think it's a superb action thriller. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I thought Martin Campbell did a great job, and it's terrific. But they're not my Bond films at all. I can't say that enough. But hey, you know what? They've made more money than any of the other Bonds, or certainly since you do the whole inflation thing, since Thunderball probably. So there's a big public enjoying them, and that's great. And obviously, Eon aren't going to listen to me and go, actually, do you know what? The £1 billion we made on Skyfall, let's not do that. Let's do License to Kill and make 100 million. You know, they're not going to listen to me. But like you said about when Craig took over and then all of a sudden Dalton gets respect and they don't like Brosnan, I think the mass public are easily, they're fickle. Not like Bond fans, but the mass public are fickle. So all of a sudden, I think if the next Bond after this one is someone who's a little bit lighter, a bit more humorous, of course, in this day and age, you're going to have a bit more character. You're never going to get away from that, and that's fine. But if it's a bit lighter, and they sell that to you as what you've been waiting for. You know, they market it. There's a line in the trailer where Bond says, I think it's about time we had some fun. You know, you put that into the trailer and all of a sudden the public go, oh, thank God, because you've had all those miserable films. This is what we wanted. You know, and then for five films, you'll suddenly have happy Bond again. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they'll go, well, we need to be serious now. And it's because the public are fickle, whereas Bond fans are, I think, are less. You know, we'll see Bond for what it is.
Point. I think that idea of fun, though, I mean, like, I correspond it to aspirational, Bond being aspirational. I mean, obviously, growing up, I just wanted to be James Bond. You know, I would be mortified if my son said to me, I really want to be like that James Bond that was binning Mathis in Quantum of Solace. Like, son, where did we go wrong? So, you know, but like, to get back to something that is aspirational and fun, like you say, would be such a tonic. It really would be.
I don't think we're going to get that. What I will say for Spectre was that it was it just me, or did it look like for the first time in four films, Daniel Craig actually looked like he was having a bit of fun? Which yeah. was for me, I think that's maybe why I enjoyed it in the cinema, because I couldn't believe he smiled yeah. two, maybe three times in the film. And he made a couple of gags, and I was like, oh, actually, okay. But then, of course, you reflect on how awful the story was, and it lets it down. Yeah. But I did feel like he was just starting to have a bit of fun in that film.
I'd agree. Until Daniel Craig nods at a double-taking pigeon, he'll not be James Bond.
He did look at a rat, didn't he, in Spectre, or a mouse or something. Yeah. Some sort of weird moment. Yeah. More of that, please. No.
I'm joking. We like that.
We might get back onto this topic later, because one of the songs we're going to discuss tonight is from a Daniel Craig film.
Really 007 is part of the Pod Dojo Network.
We will start with a choice that Steve has submitted, and it's possibly one of the top two or three most best loved, I think, not just by Bond fans, but by the general public. It's for The Spy Loved Me, and it's Nobody Does It Better. This is, I think, was it the first Bond song not to have the title in the lyrics? So it was pioneering in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously it does get mentioned in the lyrics of the song, but it's not the yes. title. I tell you what, for me, I mentioned earlier how I think there are certain defining films that mean that Bond still exists to this day. And as a Goldfinger, I think it's one. Obviously Dr. No, but then Goldfinger, because it made him into something bigger, and Thunderball capitalised on that. But I think Goldfinger was pivotal. And then we went through George Lazenby, and Connery came back, and then Roger Moore took over. Live and Let Die did pretty well. But Man with the Golden Gun, it had a pretty poor time at the box office. And for the first time, this series that has been pretty steady is looking a bit shaky. And I think it was a lot of credit goes to Cubby Broccoli and those around him for taking a bit of a gamble with The Spy Loved Me, because they spent quite a lot more money on it, bearing in mind they just had their worst box office return in the previous film. You could think, well, hang on here, we need to tighten our belts here. But they spent the most they'd spent on a Bond film on The Spy Loved Me. They made a film that has got so many classic elements in it. You can just reel them off. You know, A, it's brilliantly cast. Moore's brilliant. Barbara Bach's brilliant. It's brilliantly set up. You've obviously got the stunt with the ski jump. You've got the Lotus that goes underwater. You've got Jaws, one of the greatest henchmen in the film. You've got a story that really is very clever in the way it brings everything together. The pre-title sequence ties in with the rest of the film. That becomes what you think is just an aimless bit of action actually becomes a real thread through the film, how she is going to kill Bond because of one of the stooges he's shot in the opening scene. And it makes you actually, isn't it a nice touch that it makes you realise that those are real people too, you know? Just people who get killed in bombs you don't think about. Later in the film, it's like, no, but actually someone was in love with him. And you've got some fantastic special effects for the time. I mean, my goodness, the model effects in that film are better than some of the stuff I see today. And you've got brilliant one-liners. Oh, I could go on and on and on and on. And to cap it all off, you've got the song that basically says, this is why we love James Bond. Nobody does it better.
Hooray.
If we want to get a tissue now, wipe your eyes.
It's just like a call to arms. Absolutely amazing.
Call to arms. Well, I do know, Steve, that in a previous episode we discussed We Have All the Time in the World, and one of our regulars, John, he had that as his wedding song as they were leaving, ironically, you know, which is a bit tasteless. Sort of think back to the plot of the end of the film. But yes, that's become sort of a lovely wedding song, I suppose. But I believe you had this at your wedding. Nobody Does It Better.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had it as I had two Bond songs. I've just checked. There was just two. There was possibly more. There was definitely two. This was the first dance was Nobody Does It Better.
Oh,
and, you know, we start. Well, I just like to speak the truth. And we did the usual kind of slightly awkward shuffling around the dance floor. But when it gets to the kind of little instrumental bit, I backed away and played an invisible trumpet, and she played an invisible violin, and then everyone left, really. No, they didn't. So that was our first dance. And the other Bond song, if you will, was when my wife walked down the aisle. She walked down to, it's actually called Wine with Stacey.
No!
Oh, yes. Right, Steve.
Steve! You can't drop
this
that
is,
in now.
This is the most us thing we've ever heard.
Yeah,
most beautiful flute instrumental. Oh. One of the greatest songs.
Do you have any footage of this that we can enjoy?
Yeah.
just watch it now.
Honestly, it's one of the best pieces of music ever, Wine with Stacey.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I think the scoring of You to a Kill is... For anybody who doesn't know, because I understand Wine with Stacey sounds a bit random. Yeah, it's effectively the romantic instrumental version of the theme to A View to a Kill. And I made my wife before we got married as a kind of a test the water to see if she was actually worth marrying. She'd never seen a Bond film. Can you believe that? She had never seen a Bond film. We got together and I insisted that she watched every single Bond film. And we did it in order from the beginning. And we worked it so that it led up to Spectre coming out. And then we went to see Spectre. But A View to a Kill, my wife lived in France for a bit and she speaks fluent French and loves France, loves Paris, and she absolutely loved View to a Kill. And we're both huge music fans. I mean, you know, we very rarely have a TV on because we're listening to music all the time. And the score in A View to a Kill just blew her away. So even though I wouldn't say she became a big Bond fan, she absolutely loves the music. She loves the Maurice Binder sequences. I mean, that's what she gets excited for, is watching the guys and the girls on their trampolines and stuff. That's what she, honestly. But she loved View to a Kill. So it was an easy argument to suggest we had that piece of music as she walked in.
I don't know whether you'd be emotional or just so excited that people were hearing this music. I was like, do you like this? Do you like this? Yeah. This is brilliant, isn't it? Do you not like it? That's marvellous.
I love it. My father-in-law composed or put together some music for our wedding. I'd have loved to have had that scene where, with me saying to him, yeah, I mean, it's nice and all, but it's Wine with Stacey. Appreciate
it. Can you not just fade into Wine with Stacey? Yeah.
This is the music he gave Stacey Keach to. I mean,
my only regret was I couldn't find a wife to marry who was called Stacey, because it would have just fitted so much more neatly.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
what can you do?
Oh, that's so good. I mean, I'm committed to it as well. So I have to watch all the films. I've got Jennifer to watch the odd ones. She usually prefers the more modern. The music as well. I'll try and get her into that. But again, it's only like the newer ones. Mm-hmm. But I think there's almost too much pressure. I'm getting nervous. I showed her License to Kill fairly recently and I just couldn't. Oh, it was too tense.
I heard that podcast and you said that she thought it was newer. She was surprised at how old it was. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, I think, I think that was... Yes. Well, it might be John.
Great.
Can't remember. Yeah, one of us, yeah. Yeah.
So one of you was saying that. Yeah. And do you know what I did ask? I probably shouldn't say this because it's just embarrassing. But before each film, I did a sort of short presentation.
What a guy.
Not with a PowerPoint. No PowerPoint involved.
No.
I would
like Alan Partridge. The reenactment of Nobody Does It Better.
I just wanted to kind of set the scene of where we were in the world and where Bond was as a franchise. Because my wife's a fair bit younger. I'm 45. She's only 30. She would have been mid-20s then. So, you know, she wasn't around for a lot of the years that these Bond films came out. So I wanted to just set the scene a bit. And I don't know. She said she enjoyed those introductions. Maybe I should do them for everything we watch now. I should just get up and do a little introduction.
That's brilliant, yeah. Yeah. So you'd have to watch them each before she had for anything new, like you do with children,
I
suppose. I
should vet all the shows that she wants.
Yeah. Dear me. Oh, that's so good. That is true, though, because you don't... I think we're recently going to do Diamonds Are Forever, and a lot of it, if you judge it on today's standards... There's so much to get offended at. There's so much to object to. But if you actually just think about the time it was made and the climate. I mean, even we said when he rips the bra off the woman at the beginning and strangles her with it. We were saying that was a reaction to the... there was a furore at Miss World at the time when they were... So I'm not excusing it for a second, but there's usually some kind of context to much of it. And Yeah, I think you'd probably need to warn her for some of those films.
Well, I think Bond's violence towards women or indeed men is always as part of his job. And
absolutely.
Okay, you can say it's crossing a line because it's entertainment, but if we're taking this to the point of it being a real spy, which admittedly in Diamonds Are Forever, no one's thinking Sean Connery's a real spy. But
you just killed James Bond. Just,
yeah. Is that who it was?
But you know that would happen. You know, to an extent, yeah, violence is going to happen. They're there to. And Dalton, obviously, you know, he slaps Carrie Lowell about, and she's completely in the right. He's completely got it wrong, and he gets it wrong a lot in License to Kill, which I think is great. Not great that he leads to people getting killed, which he also does, but it shows he's fallible too. And he is funny. If I've read all the Fleming books more than once, and he's fallible in those. You know, he doesn't always get it right. It's quite surprising in some of the books. I'm surprised at how rubbish he actually is. And he has a lot of luck on his side in getting some things solved, which you don't often see in the film. So, yeah.
Anyway, what's your favourite of the books? Oh. Sorry, Steve, which is your favourite of the books?
do you know what's really strange? Is that I really like The Spy Who Loved Me, which even Fleming hated after he'd written it. And he wouldn't allow, coming back to Nobody Does It Better and The Spy Who Loved Me, he wouldn't let the producers use anything from that book, and obviously he was long dead by the time it was made, but when he signed over the deal, they weren't allowed to use any of the plot from this. Oh, look at that, beautiful. I'm loving that. Rob's holding up the book right now.
It's an old edition as well.
Because I've got all the newer versions. That's class.
It's my granddad gave this to me, so it's a treasured edition, that one.
I love it, but it got bad press at the time, I think,
different.
And then that totally different, and it turned Fleming against it, which I think is a shame because I think it's a really good thriller. I really enjoy it, and it's very, very different. Moonraker is a great book, like that. Bizarrely, being he's actually MI6, but he's in England doing a case, which Fleming kind of almost apologizes for in the book, makes, you know, his kind of random reasons why he's allowed to stay in our country and investigate. But it's a good book. But in that one, he only finds out that who the baddie is. By luck, he's still convinced the baddie's a good guy until the baddie tries to kill him. And then it's like, oh, hang on. Maybe you're not so sweet and innocent as I thought. And that shows again that he didn't always have all the answers in the books. The only book I really don't like. Have any of you read You Only Live Twice? I just can't get my head around. And I've searched the internet for moral support on this because I just found it to be one of the worst things I'd ever read, and it's so out of context to how Fleming wrote the rest of the books. I found it just absurd and awful. Wow. Really, really awful. And I thought, well, maybe Fleming was ill at that point. You know, it was but no, there doesn't seem to be. I feel quite alone. So if you guys get a chance to read it, give me your feedback on it.
I recently read Live and Let Die, which some terrible attitudes and things are said in that book, but the book itself, take that outside of it, look at it in context and when it was written, not excusing anything, it's a great thriller. It's a super thriller.
Yeah, and there's a lot of License to Kill in that book, isn't there? I mean, literally.
Well, there is, which means that Jason Gardner's follow-on, License to Kill, which is supposed to be like a legit follow-on from the Fleming books, Felix again gets bitten by a shark. In the book world, he's been mauled by a shark twice. Like, you know, the second time, I'm like, not again.
And I think it's quite funny that we always talk about License to Kill being the first not from a Bond book, but actually it's more from a Bond book than some of the others that were titled after.
So many elements from that are from Live and Let Die book. It's great. It's
amazing
got like
when I found out
heart.
He did go to the moon in Moonraker.
If it got on that,
he doesn't go to the moon in the film either. I keep saying that. Just goes in space.
Have I done enough to sell Nobody Does It Better to you, by the way? I don't know how we've ended up where we've ended up.
We absolutely love this.
it needed no wonderful selling for me, to be honest.
Oh, and Maurice Binder's sequence with it, I think, is absolutely one of his best. First one to actually feature one of the Bond actors. Roger Moore, you've clearly seen in it. But there's also some nice silhouette stuff with Moore and the girls. There's some real artistic touches where you've got the women soldiers and Bond goes to shoot them. They're all marching together, but then he puts his gun down and just pushes them and they all fall over. And it's full of lovely touches there. And I think one of his best. Yeah. Again, for a film that deserved it, it was just fabulous.
Do you see it as a... It's not... It, as a love song, or do you think it's more like an admiration, you know, that it's like you're putting Bond on a pedestal, as in, you know, like you said earlier, like, this character is the best, you know, he is capable, he can do anything and he's better than everyone else? Or do you see it as actually she's saying it about him, doesn't see any fault, you know? It's quite a very romantic view of someone else. You know, if someone said some of these lyrics, if someone thought that about you, you know, you'd be very happy, you know. So I just wondered, do you see it as a romantic kind of song, or just this idea that he is this amazing, brilliant character?
I think with the best songs that have ever been written is that you as the listener can interpret how you feel about it. And sometimes you can feel differently about a song depending when you hear it. And I think when you see and hear it in context of that film, it is a love song about James Bond, about this great spy, and he is the greatest. But I think you can also have it as a love song in its own right. And you can forget all about James Bond and just listen to it as a beautiful song. Mm-hmm. There's a great YouTube video, which I think I mentioned in one of our tweet conversations, of Carly Simon singing it. It's sort of a live concert in the 80s. Check it out, because her voice is beautiful. And she's live in some harbour somewhere. Was it Massachusetts or something? But mid-80s. It was a live concert she must have done for TV. But she's just got a beautiful voice. And to hear her singing it live, where you know it's not got the advantages of studio production, it just still, her voice is just phenomenal. So yeah, if you get a chance, check it out. Since I found that, I was researching for this podcast, I've watched that about 20 times. It's my go-to make me smile video.
There's like an added layer of drums in it as well. I was watching it today. It's really good.
There's a really funky bass guitarist behind her who's having the whale of a time.
So it is seen as a bit soft, I suppose, and it because of the success. You then have Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, All Time High, which are all, I mean, I love them, they're very mean, they're like just adult contemporary ballads, aren't they? But I mean, you know, because you've got, on one hand, you've got the big brass, the gold thing about Thunderball, the epic. Then Live and Let Die changed it with, oh, we can have an amazing rock song. And, oh, well, of course, The Man with the Golden Gun. Well, Chris will defend that on it. Hilly Will Die On. Barry's Live and Let Die. So, yeah. And then, of course, yeah, we go back to A View to a Kill for the more poppy, upbeat ones. But I don't know. I think it's another trendsetter. Unusually, of course, it isn't John Barry. It was one of the first soundtracks which he didn't do. It's Marvin Hamlisch who did the music. But the guy, I mean, he's one of the only 16 people to have won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. So he's like, oh, and he's won the Pulitzer Prize. So
wow.
He's done an awful lot. He won 3 Oscars on one night in 1973. We keep mentioning the song that keeps coming up, The Way We Were, from the film The Way We Were. And we always say, yeah, I always remember it being sung in The Naked Gun. I think, is it 2 and a half? By the guy in the shower, and then Leslie Nielsen joins in and blows his cover.
I like
he also
the
did
the
Sting,
film, actually,
which is one of John's favourite.
Oh wow, another example of the Bond producers getting the best people in a lot of the time, which hasn't always been recognised, but I think they did.
The Bond 77 music that he did.
Yes,
that's the one, isn't it? It's an outrageous piece of music. It's astonishing. If I could add, you know, about perspective on the song. When I was growing up, I always thought that it might be M. You know, like, he's basking the office. You know, like, another job well done, James. Nobody does it better. Another victory for the Secret Service. You know, that kind of thing. I always thought it might have been from the British perspective.
And apparently, Maurice Binder considered using Bernard Lee on the trampoline shots in the
don't say it. I'm so gullible, Steve. I nearly, you know, like, can you imagine Bernard Lee, like, backflips.
Yeah. Robert Brown in License to Kill. I don't think he's going to be singing this, is he? Goodness me.
No, definitely not.
It's not a country club, 007.
Only because he's not a very good singer.
Just a country club.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I think the start of this song is the perfect, like, you know, I like a movie that plays with your, it can play with your, this is such a weird way of describing it, but like your biology, your physiology a little bit, and you've got that massive high of watching Moore go off the cliff edge, and then the silence, and then the Monty Norman theme. Good. And then the twinkling piano, and your heart. I mean, I watched it on TV with my kid a couple of nights ago, and my heart is just going mad, like trying to cope with what I'm seeing. But my endorphins are just flying right through my body, going, this is the best thing ever. And it's just great. It's like the complete experience for me, the way this film starts, to be honest. It's just amazing. And the theme, the Nobody Does It Better, is such a massive part of that.
I agree entirely. And in fact, I mean, until probably the Daniel Craig era, whenever you were watching anything about Bond on TV, you know, and they wanted to do an edit that just summed Bond up, it was done to Nobody Does It Better, because you hear that and it says everything you want to say about James Bond. Nobody does it better. I don't think you could have said that about Daniel Craig in Quantum of Solace, putting people in skips. You don't feel like nobody does it better.
Nobody is grumpy.
Yeah, the song was obviously pretty massive at the time. We're going through some of the more recent ones, and The Man with the Golden Gun, even Lulu doesn't like it. John Barry hates it. So it needed a bit of a big hit, and certainly Nobody Does It Better was. It was number two in America, which is the second biggest song in America ever. There's only one which has been number one. Can anyone remember what that was? We talked about it a lot.
Thunderball?
No, we've talked
about it. It was a number one before this.
No, after. Sorry, that was confusing. It's the only one that's been number one in America, and
Adele. Was it?
No,
Adele?
No, that was the first number one in England, I think. Ooh. Yeah.
I know what it was in America. It was A View to a Kill.
Yes, it was. Yeah, the,
and it got to number two here,
based on Wine with Stacey.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And it all comes back together.
It does. Well, crackers, aren't they? Yeah. Oh, number seven in the UK. Can you imagine? What? Like six better songs at the time?
Yeah.
So good, isn't it? What is going on? But, I mean, its legacy is obviously massive, isn't it? And it was nominated for all the major categories, Oscar, Grammy and Golden Globe. It lost to You Light Up My Life, which actually kept it off the US number one. So, I mean, these are some classic songs that were around at the time. As we said, Marvin Hamlisch and the lyricist Carol Bayer-Sager, who's very famous. She wrote songs. She was actually going out with Marvin Hamlisch. That sounds a bit infantile, sorry. She was in a relationship with Marvin Hamlisch at the time. And she then went to marry Burt Bacharach. And together, she wrote the lyrics for a lot of massive songs. Sort of the ones I prefer, you know, past his 60s peak, the sort of huge number ones in America, Arthur's Theme, you know, The Best You Can Do. That's What Friends Are For, that's the one with the all-star cast. And then my favourite, On My Own, Michael McDonald and Patti LaBelle.
What a song.
And there's a Bond link, Patti LaBelle with If You Ask Me.
Patti LaBelle.
So. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and she also did the lyrics to A Groovy Kind of Love. So, this, you know, they get some top people involved, don't they?
If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod. If you do not, you will be shot!
Chris, you've got the Scaramanga one from The Man with the Golden Gun, haven't you? The tracksuit.
I have. I love the tracksuit bottoms.
Oh.
Are you wearing them now?
No.
But they look incredibly comfortable.
Yeah. They are. I think I might just wear them, just with like shirt and tie, but them at the bottom.
With a Guinness,
obviously. It's a look. Thing. I think it would work.
Yeah.
That was my favourite Bond film up until teenage years, The Man with the Golden Gun. Yeah. I loved that as a kid.
Of course.
Absolutely loved it. I think it was so much to love. You know, things stick out to you as a kid, and that car stunt obviously just was like wow. And my dad actually, he wasn't a huge film fan, but he did love Roger Moore as James Bond, and so I think there was a bit of encouragement there. But I loved Pepper, you know, as well. I mean, that sort of stuff that now irritates me a little bit, but then I loved that. I loved it, and I love the song. I know that as you said, Barry wasn't keen, and Lulu doesn't think she did a great job. But hey, I love that song. I think it's great.
It's a good song. Yeah,
it's funky. It's a great song. I mean, there's quite a few covers I was trolling the internet for. Rob, I'm really sorry I couldn't find a death metal cover of Nobody Does It Better. But I tell you what, there's a few of the other songs we're going to discuss. Yeah, I've found some metal with that, I think.
I cannot wait to hear.
The really 007 cover version.
Yeah,
it's going to be released at Christmas. Death metal versions.
Is this the point, Tom, where I talk about my trip to the Tip this weekend? Oh,
please do, Rob.
Right, I'm a boxing fan, so I go to the Tip this weekend because we've been hoarding cardboard because the Tip said it was only for essential stuff and cardboard wasn't deemed essential. Right, as soon as it's deemed essential, I'm down there, right? And I see Martin Murray, who's St. Helens boxer who's challenged for the world title 5 times. I followed his career since it began, and I went over to him and I said to him, Martin, I don't want to be that fella who disturbs you on your family time, but you're a hero of mine, and I appreciate everything you've done, and I wish you well for the future. And he said, like, you know, I appreciate that, mate. Appreciate that, you know. And we had a quick chat and whatever, and then we went on our own, you know, days, you know, whatever, and did our own stuff. And as I'm leaving, he sees me get into my car and he starts to walk over. And but I catch him walking over just too late to stop my hand from turning the ignition on my car. And as soon as I turn the ignition and he says, hiya, mate, see you later, that kind of thing. The Bluetooth connects to my phone, which is the 007, really 007 podcast episode with Christopher Lee's death metal. And it goes off top volume in the middle of the whole Tip car park. I can't hear Martin Murray. Martin Murray's trying to talk over me over the top of Christopher Lee saying, I spilled the blood of 10,000 Saxon men. And we can't hear each other. I'm like, I can't hear.
Kids want it on.
He's a hero of mine. I know, yeah. Yeah, car's empty.
Yeah, but... But guess what Martin Murray's new walk-on is for his next fight?
Exactly. Well, the thing is, the poignancy of the moment was he retired.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Martin, you know, and I'm saying, like, whatever you do next, I fully support you, man. But, well, at least, you know, I can imagine him sat at home now listening to Christopher Lee's death metal.
Oh, dear. Yeah, they're always good value cover versions. Yeah.
Weekend.
Yeah. The one for the Shaken Not Stirred was Amy Mann, which was fairly, yeah, did a good job, I think. The only other main one I could find was Radiohead did a cover, didn't they? And of course they provided the song for Spectre, but it was rejected. Now, I know everyone pretty much doesn't like the Sam Smith one, but I don't know. I didn't think the Radiohead one was quite good enough either. Doesn't necessarily mean they should have chosen that, but...
I don't think I've heard the Radiohead one, but I mean, with Sam Smith, he's the young guy, isn't he? And the producers are always desperately scared that they won't get young people to go and see these films, so they get a young person to do a song.
Do you think he's ever seen a Bond film?
Oh, well, I just don't know.
He thought he was the first gay guy to win an Oscar.
The only thing I will say...
Yeah, that's what he said in his speech, yeah.
The only thing I would say about... I did like that in Spectre, you got little orchestrations of that song in other parts of the film. And sometimes you don't... That hasn't happened recently with Bond films, and I think that's a big loss. So I did like the inclusion of it throughout the film in little places, but I didn't like the song in itself. I thought it was possibly... Well, possibly the weakest Bond song for me, but certainly up there, the top two or three, Paul.
My brother went up on and did karaoke of it at my mum's 65th, and he absolutely smashed it.
Unlike Sam Smith.
he fucking murdered him.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Dear me. But do you like it, Steve, when the theme runs through? Like Wine with Stacey, it's so nice to hear different versions of it. We will get to Living Daylights, which, you know, does absolutely. So well, doesn't it, in three different songs. But nobody does it better when you just get the occasional... Is it like a saxophone version of it, isn't there, when the shared and a shared bodily warmth and positive mental attitude and all that scene and all.
Oh, yeah.
And it just shows it all ties in. Yeah. I think with some of the films, the opening track is perhaps done after the film has been scored, and then you don't quite get that tie-in, do you? I don't think in GoldenEye, for example, I don't think Eric Serra used any of the actual GoldenEye track in the film, which is a shame because it's better than anything else he did in the film. So they could have just run that through the whole film, and I'd have been like, well, that's better.
Unusually, of course, License to Kill, though. They didn't use that, but the score was still
good. Yeah, it's a good score, that,
Very respectful, though, that score. It knew exactly what it was trying to do, who it was catered for, knew what the source material was.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I've got my two flaws with License to Kill, and they're very minor.
Oh, whoa!
So you won't. I don't think you'll hate me. Are you ready for this? Because I know.
Go on.
I may find I'm suddenly cut off the podcast at this point.
Suddenly, we have technical difficulties.
No, I think if I point out my two flaws with the film, it'll make me realize how much I love it because they're so minor. They're so minor. One is the maggots in that drawer, which just look like cooked pasta, which is apparently what they used, and it doesn't fool me at all. I remember reading
nice
like,
noises though.
Yeah, it was like they said what you wouldn't believe was that actually that's just cooked pasta, and I'm like, oh, no, it just looks like cooked pasta.
Oh,
so
no.
That's what. And like, how hard would it have been to get some maggots? I mean, I'm not.
Yeah. Well, it's a tackle film.
Tackle shop, yeah.
Fishing movie in it as well.
Fishing movie. James Bond fishing movie.
It really
well,
is.
He does say he's going fishing, doesn't he? At the end.
Yeah. At the end, Felix. It's all Felix's
fault. It all ties in.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got these maggots, Felix, and they just look like pasta. They're brilliant.
What was the second thing, Steve, you objected to? I'm really worried.
Well, do you know what? People say Dalton isn't... The humour wasn't there, whatever. But I would argue that because I think the humour is spot on with Dalton because it comes out of reality rather than just a crass one line here and there. And hey, Roger Moore can deliver those brilliantly. But I think that... What Dalton does is the scene where he introduces Q to Carrie Lowell, and it's like, oh, Q, meet my uncle, and all that stuff. So the timing of
superb,
it is brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, I think it's hilarious because he makes it seem like you can imagine that really happening. You know, this is a guy's like, oh, for goodness sake, you know. But for me, there is the one-liner, which I just think, I bet Dalton walked off set in a dispute over having to say this, was, I think he's met a dead end. Because it's just so out of place. In all that action and tension, and it's so horrific, this guy on a, you know, he's been stabbed with a forklift truck and driven through a wall. Dalton's Bond wouldn't say that, you know what I mean? He just wouldn't. And for me, that's just... It's such a small thing, but I swear that I bet Dalton was like, I bet there was arguments for weeks over, I'm not saying it.
Well, it wasn't in the ITV version, so.
Yeah. Well, they kept the graphic violence, but cut out his one-liner.
Yeah, no, the other way around, sadly.
it was great because having grown up on the ITV version and then getting it on Blu-ray later on, I think it was only last year, I finally saw Felix's real, you know, the extent of his injuries and also that moment with Hella as well. But you're right, that moment, he looks like he can't get that line out of his face quick enough.
He got the boot.
He's desperate to get on with it, isn't he? Yeah, it's
he missed his Waterloo.
So awkward. Can I add a third thing that? Because I agree with those. But can I add a third?
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa.
I know what it's going to be, and I bet I don't agree. I'm going to say you don't like how chirpy the conversation is with Felix at the end.
That's before. Yeah. Oh God. My wife is dead.
What a terrible film.
I don't mind that.
No, I don't. That's not a problem for me. That's brilliant.
Yeah,
I love it.
I just to say, because even people who are mourning, and you know, I've been there, I'm sure we've all been there, but I've been there, you are not depressed and sad the whole time. You have a phone call with your friend. It's because you want to have a break from all the emotion. Yeah. So absolutely. You might actually say, hey, you know, great, we caught the guy who did all this. Let's go fishing. You know, be like, yeah, great. Now, the moment Felix puts the phone down, and reality returns. But, you know, that's not what the scene is it? So I don't have a problem with that. I really don't.
No,
but go on, Rob. Ruin it for me. I'm never going to watch this again now.
No. It's not anybody's fault apart from behind the scenes, but it's... It's the sound design of, we got 20 keys of Colombian Pure in the tankers, and go help Heller. And then he turns and says, but we've got their money. And then the sound design changes, and there's no echo on Sanchez. And he says, I said, go help Heller. And there's no accent on, no echo, sorry. It's such a small thing.
So jarring, yeah.
It's really jarring, and every time it's like,
I'm gonna have to watch that again. You've obviously watched this with headphones on, haven't you?
I think it's just too many times. But yeah, that's it. So no. Other than that, it's perfect. We found four things in a whole film. That's pretty good going, I think.
And we've ruled out the Felix conversation.
Yes,
yeah,
so three.
Yeah, right, yeah, so it's only three. It's only three. Yeah, and I think that's tenuous at best.
Chris, I'm sure you'll agree. This is probably the most famous cover of Nobody Does It Better. Nobody does it better. Makes me feel sick for the rest. I'm Jerry. Absolutely. Hey, it's not just Russell Watson though. You'll hear some of the biggest stars of the noughties coming in. You'll instantly recognise that that is Atomic Kitten. I found this on YouTube, I have no idea what was going on, where it's at, but listen to this. Oh. It's not for Chris, I don't
know. Toes are curled all the way back.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I wish they would. Yeah. Well, it's a great song still. You can't totally ruin it. Yeah.
is that Kerry Katona's song?
I don't think her voice would be up to this. No, I don't think she's on there. I think it's the three without her when they changed. So, yeah.
I never even knew Russell Watson was in Atomic Kitten.
He was that night.
What I heard. Yeah.
Very good. You see, he's quick. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. We did a list of ranking when it was just after Christmas. We all sort of had to rank our Bonds. We're doing it on Twitter, Steve. I don't know whether you did it, but
I did. Yeah,
certainly. Well, The Living Daylights was, we voted it our second best, and I mean, it says a lot, doesn't it, when License to Kill was number one? But, I mean, for me, I can't separate them really. It's not, I don't like one more than the other particularly, but the music in Living Daylights is a massive highlight, and it's John Barry's last score, his 11th score, possibly his best. I mean, like on Honor Majesty's, the amount of music this guy's doing. He did three songs, of course. He did the title song with Aha, and he did If There Was a Man for the end titles, the ballad. And then, of course, we interviewed Necros on the show, Andreas Wisniewski, and he had his own theme tune. It was already written for him, he said. So where has everybody gone? So, I mean, it's just incredible. You know, you've got all, and you've got other themes in the score. I mean, we'll probably do an episode on the score itself, but the three songs, Chris, just can you remember them in the cinema, or were you a bit too young to remember them? Or
I remember the Aha song, just simply because of it was, you know, it's the title. Obviously, when it's the title theme, it gets played on the radio, and you see,
you know, on TV and things. But yeah, the song itself, the title song, I just think for me is, I think Bond themes fall into two categories, a sort of ballady kind of love song or slightly whimsical songs, and then there's the kind of action driven, and for me this falls in the action one. It grabs you straight off, it's very upbeat, you know, it's sort of, you know, with the drums, and obviously it's got, you know, a guitar in there, a bit of electric guitar in there, but for me it's straight off, it grabs you and it drives it. For me the song is over before, you know, too soon. I just think it's a really great theme.
Yeah.
It makes me think of it's really difficult when you listen to these three songs to not think of the score, and then when you listen to the score to not think of the songs. They're so perfectly interweaved through the entire film that it's very difficult to sort of separate them. But obviously this being the title song, it you know, it really stands out. You know, I do like a-ha as a group.
Yeah. But
it just has this, it's this sort of song that when I hear it, I want to do something exciting, you know, and I love that it makes you want to go out and go on an adventure, you know. And that's what you're saying, like Rob's talks about, like Bond being aspirational. It makes you want to go off and, you know, explore places, or, you know, go off on adventures. And I think that's so great that it kind of grabs you. And it, but it also has, you know, there's a moment where it sort of goes, like I say, goes a little bit whimsical, and then the chorus with the drums, it gets a bit aggressive, and it's just, it's for me, for late, you know, kind of rather modern kind of Bond themes, I think it's so great. And the production's really good, it's so layered, you know, you listen to it, there's brass, the saxophone, you know, the saxophone comes through, you got the guitar, you got the synths, you got the piano, everything is in there. And I just think that it really is, what a way to go out, to write three great standalone songs and then one of your best scores for the Bond franchise. It's, yeah, for me, it's, and the more, you know, let's say, it was the first film I saw at the cinema, so it will always have a special sort of place in my heart. But the more I watch it, the more I just think, it just keeps creeping up that top of the list, you know. And that's the thing with Bond films. You've got your favourites, and then you've got the ones that you appreciate because they are great films, and then you've got the ones where maybe the filmmaking's less of a, you know, less, the quality's a bit questionable, but you're still very fond of them. For me, The Living Daylights is both. I think it's a great film, and I'm very fond of it. And it's, yeah, it's it keeps going up. And it's the soundtrack that I keep putting on the most at the moment. It's such a great piece of music.
I think that's really well summed up. I can't agree with that more. I think it is a great piece of music, and where it's kind of, you can say it's of its time because it's got the poppy edge to it, but it hasn't dated. If that, it makes sense. Yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A lot of, it's always that danger with doing anything with an element of kind of time period poppy stuff that a-ha were, that it would date badly. It hasn't dated badly at all. It still stands up as a great track.
Yeah, and I think that's where Barry comes in, because his musical ear is of a sort of, I suppose, a post-war timelessness. That, let's say, with the strings and the brass, everything you associate with lush music, and whether, you know, that's film scores or just, you know, classical music, you know, modern classical music. We shared in the group chat that the album version of a-ha's, which all the Barry's influence is sort of squeezed out, and that dates, that sounds more of its time than the one that's actually used in the film. And I think that really sums up, you know, and I know obviously they had the conflicts, but yeah, I just think for me it's a great song, and it has danger and intrigue and adventure.
Yeah, this is the original. Well, it's not the original, because there was a bit of...
The album version, yeah.
Yeah, there was a bit of a fallout, wasn't there? Paul Vattar, the other songwriter, and John Barry produced a different one. It's pretty funky, and I like this version, but yeah, it's not as Bond, is it?
No.
It's a lovely beat, that.
Mm-hmm. Even the vocals are slightly different as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually quite like this version. It has dated a lot more, but
yeah,
I was listening to it last night, and it's quite funky, yeah.
He omits the, you know, John Barry's like, yeah, I like that. Yeah, we'll love that one. No.
You get an extra verse in the full length version. Either that, when you listen to that, or if you listen to the soundtrack that isn't in the actual title sequence. And there's a word that he pronounces which just doesn't sound like any word that exists in the dictionary. I've never worked out what it is. It's you know, the 100,000 people, I'm the one they blame. It's a kind of reprise of that line, slightly different words. But the last word, I don't know if he says blame, fame.
Yeah. Fame.
He kind of sort of just goes, blame. And my wife and it's I. It's like a really posh
Scandinavian accent.
Yeah. We'd have it in the car, and over we'd try and work out what it was he was singing. I don't think he knew.
No.
Oh. We have a whole episode on. Yeah. That you've misinterpreted. Yeah. Such as, nobody does it better. I used to think that keeps me from running, but just keep me coming.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. What is it?
Wrong, I was like, oh, wow.
Very rude people.
Yeah.
I remember with Living Daylights, I remember the first time I watched it was New Year's Eve, possibly 1994-5, and it was on ITV. It started at 7 o'clock. Oh. We were due at a friend's house at 8 p.m. And so me and my brother were like, obviously, we were massive Bond fans, and we were already collecting all the Bonds from the Reader's Digest, Bond VHS club or whatever, that were sending us another one.
Oh,
each
yeah,
month.
Yeah. Oh, those are so good.
It was amazing. They were so great, and the collection was so great in the end. But so it was one of those things where, right, we know we're going to get this, but it's the chance to watch The Living Daylight, and we're going to have to tape it, and we're going to have to watch it, but we can only watch the first 45 minutes. And remember, you know, we both got ready before 7 o'clock to sit down and watch it, and it was just like, it was shattering watching this. Doubly shattering. Then at 7:45, Mum and Dad going like, "Right, we're gonna go. No, don't know, because it was so mega." And then, out the door we went. Yeah, it was like, to be honest, I can't remember anything of the party. What I can remember still now is getting up the following morning, knocking on my brother's door, and going like, "Should we go and watch the rest of Living Daylight?" And going downstairs and watching the second. Yeah, the hour and, or you know, nearly an hour and a half that was left by that point. But I remember all that stuff, like the freshness of Dalton's Bond. That was the first time I'd seen him. Better Make That's Two. That's
yeah, I think two. It says that.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Better Make That's Two.
Yeah, it was so, the music was amazing. But what I feel like Barry's fingerprint on all the music in this film lends to it, and we don't get this anymore, is to a Bond film being an event, a unique event in cinema, which is an entire package for every part of you, you know, and we don't get that anymore, you know, and we haven't had that for a very long time. And that's not a criticism of the present day state of things, but how good we had it was that it was just so lucky. It was such a massive, all-encompassing thing. Barry was so incredible. And I've got to be, I'll be the first to admit that I didn't appreciate him enough at all until I've got older. When I'm looking back and I'm listening to things and then hearing Steve say, going down the aisle to Wine with Stacey. It's of course. It's the fingerprint is the word. Barry's fingerprint on Bond is so indelible.
Yeah. Just that at times, you know, we've discussed this, particularly on the Diamonds Are Forever, where he does an awful lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to the actual film itself, where the music actually offers, it makes the scene more exciting, or certainly makes it more dramatic, and that he's so good at building tension through his music, but also just making it just these. when he sort of, you used to always get those, particularly during the 60s, 70s, those little twinkling little piano versions as someone walks into a casino, and it just makes everything just so classy. I think for me, on my list of things that I love about the Bond franchise, he is in the top three. I think I cannot separate them.
I think something that struck me as well with watching Bond films is that, and this is on that point that you're making there, really, that if you think about the evolution of cinema, obviously special effects get better all the time. Sometimes they take a step back. We've all seen Die Another Day, but they generally get better. Editing techniques improve. They can cut stuff faster due to the digital suites and stuff now. They can shoot stuff in ways they couldn't before because of Steadicam and then drones and all these. Everything evolves and gets, you know, I don't want to say better because it doesn't always make a better film, but gets better. But what doesn't get better is the ability to score an orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So there is nothing that has changed about orchestrating a film from, well, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s to what you have now. So it's kind of weird that all other elements of films have changed and, you know, have taken on different techniques and arguably what they can do with their vision is greater. But what hasn't changed is the orchestration. So nothing that John Barry did will ever date
mm-hmm.
because you can't necessarily do it any better. Nothing changes to make it better. And that's why I think you watch those older Bond films and the thing that often stands out is the music is so good because it hasn't, unlike the rest of the film where you can see it's dated in the way things are made now, the music hasn't dated at all. It's just beautiful and stunning and it will never date because technology doesn't change how you work with an orchestra.
Yeah, and I don't think let's say in the past we've had some great composers that have worked on the Bond films, but no one understands Bond musically better than Barry, and I think you can see that we've seen like on Twitter Stephen Carty took a few seconds from Spectre where Bond walks across the sort of the ledge and puts Barry's music on suddenly. I want to watch that film.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly, Daniel Craig looks cool. Suddenly, it looks like I just can't express just what he brings to these films and just the choices of where to bring in the Bond theme and where to bring in the theme song, and then it's just. Oh.
Stephen Carty also did for another scene in Skyfall when he's being led on that yacht with Severin. He put the Mujahideen an opium track from Living Daylights. And it was just like the most sweeping music. People think when they heard that in the cinema, like this is more than a Bond film. Like this is just on another level musically, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Really the best.
Join us for part two where we discuss the other songs of the Living Daylights, as well as the classic Another Way to Die.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.